Chapter 21. The nightmare of his existence hadn't ended. In fact, it had only worsened. Felix Cassander, though that name meant little to him now, stalked back and forth in what had once been a Medicaid quarantine bay aboard the Pride of the Emperor. His bones ached, each joint stiff with broken glass pain, and his one remaining lung filled with acid-burning fluids that he hacked up his throat with crippling regularity. His supra-engineered frame was keeping him alive, despite his fervent desire for death. He and Navara were two amongst perhaps a dozen of Fabius's terata that had survived the assault on the Iron Hands vessel. Navara lay in abject misery in the corner of the quarantine cell, his mutated body undulant with motion as his internal anatomy combined and split apart in genetic revolt, and his limbs reshaped themselves in response to hypermutation of his base pairs. The Terrata were little better than beasts now, howling, mindless things of appetite and aggression, but Cassander and Navara alone had held on to the remembrance of their former lives. Navara's mind hung by a thread, a teetering consciousness that kept true to the word of Dawn, only thanks to Cassander's incessant repetition of the Legion's role of honour, starting with the Victorix Roma and ending with Honoris Martius. His own fractured sense of self remembered who he was, where he had come from, but most of all it remembered what he had done. He had killed space marines loyal to the Imperium. He was no better than the Emperor's children or the Iron Warriors. The pain of his minute-by-minute existence was nothing compared to that. It was his punishment, his penance for giving in to adversity. He was one of the Emperor's own fists, a warrior against whom no foe could triumph, for whom no obstacle could delay and no pain could master. All of it a lie. Cassander picked at his muscle-bloated arms, the flesh scabbed with pus-filled sores that refused to heal as fresh toxins made war against his gene-twisted immune system. He had picked all the flesh from his right hand, leaving it a rotten, meat-flaked ruin. Rich crimson blood coated the bones there, the digits held together by strings of sinew and scraps of regenerative muscle tissue. He'd scraped intricate patterns into the bone with the overgrown claws of his other hand, relishing the agony of his self-mutilation and knowing it wasn't nearly enough to atone for what he had allowed to happen. He could still see the face of the legionary whose throat he had ripped out, the hatred that burned in his eyes. It was a hatred well earned. Though he had torn the flesh from his hand, he knew it would never be free of the loyal blood it had spilled. He tried to keep his focus on the blood, hoping that preoccupation with pain would keep the horror of what he had done and what he had become at bay. Cassander's perceptions were becoming ever more erratic, a collage of nightmarish images that belonged in a madman's skull. Torturous experiments, pain-filled lights in his eyes, and the crack of breaking bones as his body was continually reshaped and regrown. The passage of time itself was out of sequence, fragments of memory making no sense from one instant to the next. One moment he was clawing the skin and meat from his guilty hand, the next he was staring up at a bank of lumen strips in a clinically austere chamber of white ceramic tiles and steel girders painted a bilious industrial green. Being strapped to the gurney meant pain, and pain was all he wanted now. Pain meant escape. Pain was penance. The source of all his pain leaned over him, haloed in stark light and clicking machine arms.
"You are special, my child," Fabius told him, a rivulet of black blood running from the corner of his mouth. "You fists retain your higher functions. The rest devolve to beasts, but not you two. Why is that, I wonder?"
Cassandra wanted to reach for the demented apothecary and tear out his throat, but the chains securing him to the table this time were as good as unbreakable. Fabius grinned his corpse grin at him and shook his head.
"You think I learned nothing from our last contretemps?"
said Fabius, stepping away and altering the angle of the gurney upon which Cassandra lay.
"The pride of the Emperor might not be as private as the Andronicus, but it at least has the virtue of many well-equipped Medicaid levels."
In complete opposition to the apothecary's previous lair, this space was brightly lit and organized much like a conventional Medicaid facility. The walls were lined with machinery that Cassandra could not identify, save that they were all bespoke creations that no apothecary in a loyal legion would sanction using. Secured cabinets were filled with green glass beakers in which swilled unidentifiable mutant offspring, genetic abnormalities, and hideously deformed fetal stages. Rows of reductor ampoules, each one labelled with a legion symbol and engraved with what looked like a name, sat in a glass cryovat filled with coils of nitrous gases. Tissue baths, centrifuges and retorts bearing bubbling tubes and bell jars hissed, spat and boiled on a silver-steel workbench, and an opened corpse lay on the gurney to his left amid the labelled, spliced and sectioned portions of his inner anatomy. The corpse had no head, but a Legion tattoo on his right bicep revealed him to be 4th Legion.
"Turning on your own now," said Cassandra through his mangled jaw structure.
Fabius turned to look at the dissected corpse as though he had forgotten it was there.
"Even before Horus chose rebellion," he said.
"Why?"
gurgled Cassandra, flexing the bones of his mutilated hand as it throbbed painfully.
"Because we are led to believe we are perfect creations," said Fabius, coughing a wad of black phlegm and holding his chest. "But nothing could be further from the truth. We are fragments of a greater whole, pale reflections of something incredible. Each of the Legion's genetic structure contains a piece of that perfection, and I would know every secret of the Emperor's workings."
"Why?"
repeated Cassandra, knowing it was the most important question.
"Because I don't want to die," said Fabius, opening his robes to reveal 2 suppurating wounds crusted with tarry deposits.
Sword wounds, but ones that hadn't healed.
"The Emperor's soldiers who came before us, the Thunder Warriors, their gene code carried the seeds of their own destruction. And the gene-boosted savages before them, they were fortunate to live as long as they did before their hypermetabolism consumed them. The Primarchs think their warriors are immortal, but they are wrong. We are as mortal as any living thing. We just take longer to die. I would not have it so."
"You want to live forever?"
"Of course," said Fabius, angry he should even ask such a question. "Don't you?"
"No," hissed Cassandra. "I want to die with every breath."
Fabius leaned over him, and the chirurgeon extended its claw-like caliper arms. The razor-thin line of a thermal cutter sparked to life. A host of thick needles extended from another arm, followed by a blood siphon and a clacking suture gun on 2 more.
"If that were true, then why have you not dashed your brains out against the walls of your cell?"
asked Fabius, with the keen interest of a scholar. Cassandra had only one answer.
"Because I am weak," he said, his powerful, mutated and abhorrent form heaving in torment.
"No, my child, you are strong, so very strong. The others supercombusted with the fury of their accelerated metabolism, but not you or your legion brother,"
said Fabius almost tenderly.
"That's why I need to open you up again.
The thermal cutter descended, and the pain began again.
Atonement and agony. Penance and pain.
Cassandra welcomed them all. Warsmith Toramino paced the ramparts of the landing zone fortress, watching with ever greater anger as the Numakina and his warriors battled to shore up the walls. Cracks spread and stone crumbled with every passing moment. This world was anathema to the raising of foreign walls, and the sooner they were done with this place, the better. Not even the aural filters on his helm could keep out the keening wail of the wind, and the crepuscular glow emanating from the distant city was grating on Toramino's nerves. Bad enough that he had been denied his rightful place in the Trident, but now he had been left as little better than a watchman. The master of the Storbizashk commanded firepower like no other, a host of ordnance, and the means to deploy it. That he should be consigned to this lowly role was an insult to his pride and to the honour of his title. True, in a war zone, such a task was a position of great importance and respect, but defending empty platforms and runways enclosed by high walls, minefields, and acres of razor wire on a deserted world was a task with no honour and which offered no hopes for advancement. Such a task was for low-born fools like the Stone Rot, or, more appropriately, Kroger. Harker's foolish recklessness on Hydrocordatus had brought this situation about, but the former warsmith of the 23rd Grand Battalion was Olympian high-born, and even a fool of a noble was better than peon scum like Kroger. Toramino paused to look back into the heart of the defences constructed within the crumbling and sagging walls. A forest of cannon barrels angled to the sky like a thousand arms raised in salute. Howitzers, bombards, thunderstrikes, mortars, rocket batteries and precision hunter-killer missiles. Gunmasters and their crews swarmed their weapons, ready to unleash a rain of explosive death on any target that presented itself. Not that Toramino particularly expected that target to be a foe in the traditional sense. It galled him that circumstances had forced his hand to fratricide, but when backed into a corner by the ignorance and jealousy of fools, what could any high-born warrior of rank and position do but fight back? He called up the schematics of the city onto his data slate, the real-time information fed to him by the topographical data engines on the Castellan Rhinos. A three-dimensional image of the city, its buildings, and the location of the Iron Warrior's advanced fortress hovered before him. With such detailed target information, Toramino could flatten the Eldar tomb city with a word, or pick out one structure to demolish while leaving the rest untouched by so much as a shrapnel scar. He fed the data to the target acquisition engines of his gunmasters, relishing the sheer destructive power at his command. Toramino put away his data slate as the wind's lament changed in pitch, becoming more strident and insistent. He banged a palm against the side of his helmet, cursing and shaking his head in an effort to silence it. It was no use. The sound was only getting more irritating, and Toramino unsnapped the gorget seals, tearing his helmet off to reveal his patrician features and mane of ivory hair. He sat the helmet on a toothed merlin and tilted his head to the side. Toramino's eyes narrowed as he stared at the horizon in puzzlement. A faint haze rippled at the farthest extremes of his sight, a blur of greenish light like the approach of a distant sandstorm. What is that? He wondered, over the keening wail of the mournful wind. Perturabo led the way, the pace necessarily slow as the enveloping darkness made haste impossible. The advance force kept tight together, a column of armoured warriors with blades bared and firearms primed. Even Fulgrim's host kept their howls and chants to themselves. The heavy footfalls of Warsmith Barossus echoed from the obsidian walls, and the brittle clatter of glass from the containers being carried by Fulgrim's mortal followers was a constant presence in the swallowing darkness. The walls remained uniformly smooth, but distant lights swam in their glossy depths. Wheeling like distant galaxies and just as populous, there was a universe of stars within the walls, Perturabo realized, each one distinct and no two alike. He wondered what they might represent. Were the shimmers of light a purely aesthetic consideration on the part of the sepulchre's builders, or might they serve some unknown function? Could they be a self-repair mechanism, such as possessed by the Cadmean Citadel? An infestation of some lithobiotic parasite? Or perhaps the remnant of an ancient computational archive? Could this entire structure be a form of data repository, a species record of a once dominant empire now fallen into decline? Perturabo knew better than anyone the value of the wisdom of the ancients. Hadn't he constructed the Cavia Ferrum from the designs of a dead genius? This labyrinth was constructed from the same principles, its intricacies working in multiple overlapping dimensions at once, and Perturabo understood that firmness of purpose was the best instrument of success when navigating a maze. That and the non-Euclidean equations of the Firenze. When ancient mathematicians first discovered the dimensions beyond the physical, many a classical scholar had been driven to insanity in his attempts to codify his findings in empirical terms. Thanks to the words encrypted in the secret journal of the Firenze, the slender volume the Crimson King had helped him decode, Perturabo had learned the secrets of navigating such tempestuous calculus. It was an inexact science, not meant for mortal brains to comprehend, but his cognitive reach was far beyond those lunatic geniuses who had tried and failed to grasp the enormity of the worlds they had glimpsed in dreams and fugue states. When Perturabo had first climbed to the top of the cliffs of Lokos as a youth and seen the Eye of Terror looking down at him from the other side of the galaxy, he had known instinctively there was a universe beyond its hellish borders, a place of dark miracles and nightmarish wonders. With every decade that passed and every fragment of knowledge he uncovered, its impossible mechanics became ever more visible and less unknowable. Perturabo had gradually peeled back layer after layer of mystery until the alien mechanisms at its heart lay revealed to him. The last part of the key had been provided by the discovery of the plans in the Sabellian cremation pit, the final heretical workings of the Firenze, and Perturabo had revelled in the white heat of immaterial mathematics and imperial geometry as he crafted the impossible roots and impenetrable depths of the Cavia Ferrum. What was at play here was no different. Worked with a subtlety and grace that was breathtaking, but fundamentally the same. He kept silent, and shut out the echoing sounds around him as he processed the fiendishly difficult calculations that laid bare the workings of the labyrinth. He paid no attention to the matrices of darting light that passed through the walls, the panicked flickers of lambent mist swirling in their depths, nor did he note the passage of time or the insistent clicking of vox traffic from beyond the sepulchre. Fulgrim kept close, stealing awed glances at him as he chose each turn in the maze, leading them deeper and deeper into its convoluted depths. Their path took them up and down, through spiralling walkways, back around on themselves, and through chambers, tunnels, and echoing halls designed to confuse and disorientate. Perturabo kept true to his principles of interdimensional calculus and forced his natural instinct for direction to cede control of their course to his intellect. He sensed his brother's frustrations at the labyrinth and his inability to map it in his head. Even boastful Dawn would find it next to impossible to navigate the maze of the Cavia Ferrum, let alone this exquisite alien rendition of its myriad complexities. The path through the maze was elaborate and layered, twisting like a nest of writhing snakes and rearranging around him in relation to their onward passage. With every step, Perturabo felt the gelid sentience at the heart of this world, if it even was a world, and he was beginning to have his doubts, becoming ever more focused in its attentions. Whatever lay beneath them, the dreams of a dormant god or a reactivating cache of sentient weapons, Perturabo knew they didn't have much time until it grew powerful enough to actively resist them. With a sudden self-aggrandizing epiphany, Perturabo knew with absolute certainty that he alone, in all the galaxy, was capable of navigating this labyrinth. Not even Fulgrim's pet guide could have done so. Far from pleasing Perturabo, the thought struck a discordant note of imminent threat. Fixing points of reference in his mind, spatial, imperial, and mathematical, Perturabo halted their progress at an intersection of four passageways. Each was superficially identical, yet only one offered onward passage. "Why do we stop?" asked Fulgrim. "We must be near the heart of the labyrinth by now."
"We are," agreed Perturabo. "One of these passages will lead us to whatever lies beneath the central dome we saw from outside. The rest leads to eternities of wandering and madness."
"But you know which to take."
"I do."
"Then why do we hesitate?"
"Berossus," commanded Perturabo, "bring me Vora."
The thunderous form of Warsmith Berossus hauled the cringing Eldar forwards, the push of the dreadnought's heavy hammer ungentle. Stealing furtive glances at the behemoth behind him, Karuchi Vora bowed to Perturabo. The guide looked terrible, thin and wasted, as though the life was being drawn from him with every step he took into the labyrinth.
"My lord," said Vora.
"The lights in the walls," said Perturabo. "What are they?"
"It is difficult to explain, Lord Perturabo," said Vora. "My people do not craft walls of stone and steel as you do."
"Yes, you grow your structures from some biopolymer," said Perturabo. "I've brought more than one to ruin over the centuries. But answer the question, what are the lights in the walls?"
"What does it matter how this place is built?" snapped Fulgrim, before Vora could answer, eager to be moving on.
"It matters because I say it matters," said Perturabo, taking hold of Karuchi Vora's robe and easing him forwards to stand facing the four onward passages. Each was dark, with nothing to differentiate them from the hundreds of others they had travelled. "Which one?" said Perturabo, resting his hand lightly on Vora's shoulder.
"My lord?"
"Which one?" repeated Perturabo. "We are almost at the heart of the sepulchre, so I want you to tell me which of these passages will lead us there."
Karuchi Vora glanced nervously back at Fulgrim, as Perturabo knew he would, before hesitantly lifting his arm and pointing to the passageway second from the left.
"That one," said the Eldar.
"Wrong," said Perturabo, snapping Vora's neck.
The sense of claustrophobia in the Iron Warrior's stronghold had been overpowering, and Julius Caeseran's innards squirmed to be free of his body with every moment he'd paced its bland, steel-edged courtyard. Like a caged raptor, he was not suited for confinement or to remain static behind high walls. A wise man had once told him that stagnation was death, and that was never truer than of the Emperor's children. The lords of profligacy had lifted the suffocating veils of the mundane from their eyes and shown them unlimited worlds of sensation and indulgence. Undreamt vistas of excess in all things, noise, music, bloodshed, hedonism, torture, violence, adoration, and most of all, worship. Every second not spent indulging desires declared taboo in an earlier age was a waste of life, and Julius Caeseron had long since declared that no act of indulgence would remain beyond his grasp. Leaving the dull-minded iron warriors behind their impermeable walls, Julius led his 3,000 warriors into the plaza before the sepulchre, leaving them to desecrate and destroy as they saw fit. Julius revelled in the sensation of untapped power he felt seeping up into the world like oily water in sodden sand. He bludgeoned crystalline statues and smashed the glowing stones against his skull, grinding the crushed fragments into the cuts in his skin. The anticipatory pleasure was almost as great as the indulgence, and his altered sight perceived the lines of force and memory that threaded every structure on this planet. He marvelled that the iron warriors couldn't see it, and almost pitied them, their limited perceptions. How intolerable their lives must be, restricted to seeing only the functional building blocks of what was deemed reality by their own stunted senses. Julius and his warriors circled the Iron Warriors' fortress, thousands of whooping and yelling maniacs holding weapons and war banners high. The energy saturating this world was on the verge of release, like a volcano on the brink of eruption, or a singer approaching a high note. He wished he could puncture whatever was holding it back, letting its bounty flow through the streets like a surge tide to drown them all. He laughed hysterically, drawing his combat knife and plunging it up into the space beneath his skin-draped shoulder guard and scored breastplate. The pain was fleeting, the flow of blood momentary, but with every droplet that spilled onto the ground, he felt this world's horror grow. With a certainty not his own, he understood that his blood was polluted with something wonderful, something intolerable to the race that had built this world. Blood was his devotion, its substance tainted by the force that had ripped its way to life from the afterbirth of this race's death. In that instant, he knew what he had to do. Julius threw aside his knife, its blade too small and inconsequential for what needed to be done. He drew his serrated sword, the blade impregnated with hooked barbs worked along its length. He howled his submission to the kaleidoscopic skies and charged into the chanting mass of his warriors. His first blow hacked one of Verosian's cacophonae in two, blood erupting from the mutant's body like an exploding fuel bladder. His second opened the belly of a warrior whose armour was so torn it should have been discarded long ago. A third beheaded a bullish champion whose neck jetted twin fountains of blood 3 metres into the air. Julius barged and cut and hacked his way into the Emperor's children, feeling his certainty that this was the right thing to do, with every opened artery, every severed limb and every drop of blood spilled. He laughed as he saw the Iron Warriors looking on in horror as he slaughtered his brother legionaries, their incomprehension plain even through their flat, expressionless helmets. The stink of blood filled his senses, together with a potent sense of being on the cusp of something magnificent. Following his lead, the Emperor's children fell upon one another in an orgy of bloodletting, all cohesion and sense of purpose forgotten in the lustful savagery of killing. Julius remembered the blossoming sense of freedom he'd felt in La Fenice when the avatars of the Lords of Profligacy manifested through the broken shells of mortal bodies. The exquisite pain and ecstatic feeling of being truly alive had faded with time, and to feel that again, he would endure any pain, inflict any suffering. No sooner had he wished for it than he felt a tugging sensation in every cell of his body, a pleading invitation to surrender his flesh.
"No, not yet. Let me enjoy this a little longer."
The entire plaza before the sepulchre was now a killing floor, a battlefield with no enemy, just a screaming host of warriors bent on self-destruction. The Emperor's children offered themselves up as willing yet unwitting sacrifice, their blood carrying with it the memory of life and death, birth and doom. The power at the heart of Aedris spasmed in hateful recognition of that contradiction, and awoke.
"Brother!"
cried Fulgrim, as Perturabo dropped Vora's lifeless body to the floor. Perturabo ignored his brother's shock and marched in the direction of the leftmost passageway. His warriors moved off with him, the iron circle matching his swift stride effortlessly and without complaint. Berossus passed insultingly close to the Phoenician as he strode on. Fulgrim's hand closed on Perturabo's arm, and he rounded on his brother, his fist balled in anticipation of violence. The iron circle turned with a clatter of shields and armaments, every carapace weapon aimed squarely at Fulgrim.
"Do you really have to ask?" demanded Perturabo.
"Ask what?" said Fulgrim, backing away with a look of outrage that made Perturabo sick to his stomach with its theatricality.
"Karuche Vora had never set foot on this world before now, had he?" said Perturabo.
Fulgrim's mask finally cracked, and he grinned. The liar exposed, the deceiver unmasked.
"I doubt it," said Fulgrim. "But even if he had not, does it truly matter?"
"Of course it matters," said Perturabo, teeth bared, "because he couldn't possibly have reached this far into the labyrinth. Yet he claimed to have seen the weapons we seek. How do you explain that, brother?"
Fulgrim shrugged, and Perturabo had never wanted to take Forge Breaker to a skull more than he did at that moment. He lowered his fist slowly and turned away before his anger got the better of him.
"I knew you were lying to me from the start," he said, "but I held on to a shred of hope that there might be a fraction of truth to what you promised. More fool me! I should never have come here with you, brother."
"No, I needed you to come," implored Fulgrim, following him but making no moves to touch him. "I may have exaggerated some aspects of the Eldar legend, but I knew that only you could navigate this labyrinth."
"So why lie to me? Why create this fiction?"
"Would you have come if I told you I needed you just to unravel a maze?"
"No," said Perturabo.
"There, you see."
Perturabo nodded in the direction of the passageway and said,
"So what are we really going to find in here? What could be so important to you that you would expend so many lives and lie to your brother?"
"Exactly what I promised," said Fulgrim. "The ability to destroy worlds and lay waste to armies. The power of the Angel Exterminatus lies at the heart of this world, truly. But it will take the two of us to unlock it." "No more lies, brother. Not now we are so close to victory."
Despite himself, Perturabo could feel his curiosity piqued. Fulgrim had lied and cheated and deceived to bring him this far, but he heard no falsehood in this latest declaration. Even so, he didn't believe his brother's vacant sincerity. Whatever lay at the heart of the sepulchre would be Perturabo's alone.
"Then we will seize it together," he lied.
The carnage being wreaked beyond the Strongpoint's walls was as horrific as it was senseless, and Forex could only watch in open-mouthed incomprehension as the Emperor's children systematically butchered themselves. Warriors who had marched together beneath the same banners now hacked at each other with great broadswords or unloaded entire magazines into their corpses. The wet sound of steel on flesh and the barking rattle of gunfire filled the plaza. Forex had no intention of moving aside the rhinos, barring entry to his position to allow those few warriors not partaking in the slaughter back within his walls.
"What in the name of the 12 are they doing?" said Forex, gripping the steelwork of the battlements with his powered gauntlets. "It makes no sense."
Standing beside him, Volbron shook his head.
"I have no idea.
After what I saw on the pride of the Emperor, I've given up trying to figure out any sense in the Third Legion.
But this is so wasteful, shouted Forex, the metal bending beneath his grip.
Did you see what started it?
I don't know what started it, but I know who, said Forex, pointing at the blood-drenched figure of Julius Caesaron as he fought like a demented berserker through those few Emperor's children still standing. The captain's sword was red with entrails and torn flesh, his hysterical screaming like fingernails on slate.
"Should we try and stop it?" asked the Stonerot.
"You want to get in the middle of that?"
"Not when I've a wall to stand behind."
"Then we leave them to it," said Forex. "The fools!" The killing didn't take long to burn itself out. Thousands of lives ended in a convulsion of manic death-dealing. Forex had never seen anything like it. As silence fell over the plaza, only Julius Caesaron was left standing, his purple and gold armour entirely covered in crimson and loose dribbling chunks of skin. The sword fell from his hand, and he slumped to his knees, a plaintive shriek of something dark and primal torn from his throat. The warrior buried his head in his hands, and he fell forwards as though grovelling to some unseen liege lord.
"I don't know why Caesaron did this, but I'm damn well going to find out," said Forex, descending to the courtyard of the strong point and summoning his fellow Terminators to his side. Together with five other towering warriors, he marched to the Rhino Gates. With a nod, the two vehicles retracted their bracing footings from the ground and started their engines with a throaty, metallic cough.
"I will be the iron within," said the Stonerot, as the rhinos reversed.
"As I will be the iron without," replied Forex, leading his warriors beyond the walls. The gates closed behind them as Forex marched towards the weeping form of Caesaron. The plaza was an abattoir, a charnel house of ripped bodies, emptied bellies and wasted lives. The iron warriors gave the dead no reverence, crushing the remains beneath their feet without remorse. With every step they took, Forex felt the hostility and unseen eyes that had been upon them ever since their landing intensify their scrutiny, as if they were now within easy reach. He halted before Caesaron, who lifted his head at their approach. The man's face was a horror of liquid scar tissue, burned meat and monstrous surgery. Whatever he had looked like before was utterly obscured beneath a leathern mask of self-inflicted mutilations. Caesaron grinned, exposing rotten teeth, twisted fangs, and a lizard-like tongue of reptilian scales.
"We got their attention," he rasped through a mouth clogged with mutant flesh.
"What are you talking about?"
"The dead," rasped Caesaron. "We goaded them, and they came. Now the angel exterminatus can rise from the ashes of his unmaking."
"You killed your own men," said Forex.
"They weren't mine," said Caesaron. "They never were."
"No? Then whose were they?" Caesaron seemed to consider the question, tilting his head to the side as though listening for an answer. Then he smiled, and his face pulled apart as the skin folded back on itself, sloughing from his skull.
"They belong to Slaanesh!"
screamed Caesaron in revelatory ecstasy. Forex recoiled from the name, feeling it stab into him like a curse. Then, from all around the plaza, Forex heard a snap and crash of grinding glass. The omnipresent wail that keened on the mournful wind grew to a wounded shriek as thousands of plumes of illuminated smoke erupted from the ground. Forex and his Terminators immediately formed a defensive circle, autoloaders feeding shells into the breaches of combi-bolters. "Stand to," ordered Forex. "Stonerot!" Through the plumes of writhing mist, Forex saw the surviving crystalline statues throwing off their previous immobility. They moved swiftly, like sleepers awoken from an eons-long slumber, and the gems at the heart of their bulbous heads bled vibrant colour into glassy bodies that suddenly seemed significantly less fragile. Kaeseron's warriors had ruined many, but hundreds more remained in the plaza, not to mention the thousands still standing between them and the citadel's walls. Forex felt his heart sink as he saw the titanic guardians of the portal were moving too. Light poured through their enormous limbs from the gemstones set throughout their bodies, and the sweeping, wing-like spines at their shoulders blazed with coruscating energies. Spumes of shimmering light washed from their fists, and the crack and grind of their flexing joints was like the splitting of a glacier. "Back to the strong point," he ordered. "Now!" The lumbering terminators moved as one, but before they had taken more than half a dozen steps, their way was blocked. Not by the glassy construct stepping from their plinths, but by an army of spectral warriors coalescing from the emerald-lit mists. Thousands upon thousands of their shimmering forms filled the plaza, clad in form-fitting plates of armor and armed with long blades. White eyes shone through translucent porcelain helmets, and Forex felt their intense hatred for him. Though it ran contrary to every secular belief in his head, he understood exactly the nature of this army of wraiths. These were the Eldar dead of Aedris.